This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Write What You Know and Other Pearls of Wisdom, the worst writing and publishing advice.
So this week, I think we're just going to have a little bit of fun.
Yes, we were talking about what to do for the episode, and we realised that we hadn't done a writing-focused one for a while, and I think both of us have encountered these little gems at certain points during our respective careers here. So we're going to try unpacking some of them a little bit. Before we start, if this happens to be the first episode of Dissecting Dragons you've ever listened to, you might be sitting there wondering, who the hell are you to give me writing advice or to tell me to ignore writing advice, more to the point. Basically, obviously, I am a science fiction, fantasy and historical fiction writer.
Yes.
And I have had, or rather, I'm a hybrid writer, which means that I have signed traditional contracts with publishing houses, and I have also indie published books as well. I'm currently on something like my fourth or fifth contract. I'm not sure which one it is. So I know a little bit about the sort of legal publishing side as well. I know the brain is going, you know, the flesh is willing, but the brain is really kind of like, I've had enough of this stuff, you know? I'm not a big name or anything, as you probably guessed, but I am sort of comfortably sort of edging into the mid list, so I do kind of know what I'm talking about. And obviously Madeline.
Yes, so I am in the same position as Jules in that I've not had quite as many contracts as her, but I'm a hybrid, so that I've done traditional publishing and then self-publishing and indie publishing. I'm the head writer of a startup gaming studio, and I'm a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Winchester. So between us, we do have some experience in these matters. And I think it's worth saying that some of the advice that we'll be talking about today, there's a duality to them.
Yeah.
So actually, depending what stage you are in your writing, you might actually find some of the advice useful to you. And if it is useful to you, we encourage you, you know, not to feel like you've been doing something wrong if it's, you know, a kind of a pathway you've been following. And in fact, a couple of the ones that I'm going to talk about today were things that I used and found helpful and lived by when I started up writing as well. So don't feel like this is a mass criticism on all of these bits of writing advice. We're mostly just talking about actually recognizing the potential issues with these, and occasionally we're talking about some which are actually pretty bad just in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the real issue, and the one that I tend to get really annoyed about, is anything which is absolutist or prescriptive writing advice. You must do it like this. There is no other way. And the thing is, that just isn't true with writing advice. There's no one path. There's no one golden road up the mountain. And different shortcuts and different techniques and things will work for different people. And it's absolutely fine. And also, the journey will take different amounts of time for different people. So you're not doing something wrong if it takes you 20 years and it takes somebody else 20 months. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely nothing at all.
So, on that note, let's get going.
Yes. Okay, so I think we should probably start with the big and obvious one. And I should also just say, before we started this episode, Jules and I said, right, we're going to write a list of the worst writing advice that we've been given. And then we compared notes and we had pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah, almost exactly. So there you go. The interesting thing, obviously, is most of our published journey, Madeline and I have taken side by side, even though it's taken slightly different routes.
Yeah.
So we've probably encountered things at more or less the same sort of time as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay, so let's start with a really, really obvious one, which is write what you know.
Yes. This is a tricky one, and this is writing advice that's been around for hundreds of years. This is literally what various different eminent poets of the day said to people like Charlotte Bronte, for example. I mean, another one did actually also say writing ought not to be the business of women. So she then went on and became a writer who is well known, even though that particular poet is almost lost in the mists of time. So so obviously that bit about writing not being the business of women, I hope we all know that's bullshit. But write what you know. The trouble is that write what you know is actually not a very descriptive piece of writing advice. If we all just wrote what we knew, what we actually knew, that we had actually lived ourselves, the world would be full of very dull biographies.
Yeah.
And now, treatises on engineering and things like that.
Which, again, those can be interesting. Yeah, I do think the problem is it's a highly deceptive piece of writing advice, which is both very useful and actually entirely contradictory to a lot of other writing advice. So let's dissect, see what I did there. Let's dissect a little bit of what it means to us personally, because I do still actually kind of believe in the moniker of write what you know. But I think that it shouldn't be taken too literally.
No, and I have to say, in my head, I amend it to start with what you know. So if we were to look at my Unveiled series, for example, I don't actually know what it's like to live in a haunted vicarage or to have this great weight of, oh, by the way, you now serve Lord Death thrust down upon me. That's obviously not something that I could also do due diligence on, really, because I don't know anybody in that particular position. I don't know how to find anyone in that position, assuming anyone ever is. What I do know is I know landscape, I know folk horror, I know folklore, I know ghost stories. So I started with what I knew and wove something different from that, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think a big part of Write What You Know is actually a commentary on research. On the one side, which is that you've got to kind of be well acquainted with the subjects that you're talking about if you want to actually write them with any seamlessness and with any authority. It's as simple as that. But I also think that on some level, Write What You Know is actually a good piece of writing advice, not just in terms of the subject matter, but in terms of connecting with your reader. And I think writers do it unconsciously anyway. But drawing on the things that you recognise in order to kind of make even the most fantastical worlds familiar is a big part of writing what you know. So if you were someone who suffered from bullying, if you were someone who had this experience or that experience, or, you know, had these strong, intense friendships and things like that, you can write the most savagely, you know, fictional thing in the entire world and still make it relatable. J.K. Rowling was not a boy wizard who was raised in a cupboard under the stairs, met a giant and went to a magical school, so far as we know.
Yeah.
And yet, despite the fact that none of us really sort of frequently, and I say none of us frequently, I mean, I don't know what you're doing at home right now, but, you know, not many of us are jumping onto the back of flying brooms and playing Quidditch. You know, there aren't that many of us doing that. And yet there is something distinctly familiar about Hogwarts and that world. It's the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, even though they've got all this magical stuff happening, they've also kind of got to do homework, and they have friendships, and, you know, they're playing chess, and they're going on little adventures, and they're bantering and things like that. Those are the things which we know about, which are actually what make the story feel welcoming and homely.
Yeah.
So drawing on your experiences like that, I think, really adds an element of realism to any particular story.
Yeah, I think, see, the thing is, Write What You Know is often touted as writing advice for people starting out, and there's a good reason for that, as you've just said. And I think where it comes unstuck is that newbie writers can sometimes feel that they can only write what they know, and perhaps they're not confident in getting their own experiences across, or they think that means, oh, well, in that case, I have to write something I actually don't like.
Yeah.
I don't want to write about this particular experience, or I don't want to package it. I think it can be a packaging issue. Maybe you don't want to write about the death of a loved one, for example, in terms of a contemporary setting that you understood and knew very well and experienced. Maybe you want to write it and set it in space or something, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously you don't live in space, so you don't know it. But, you know, that's all things you can add to your knowledge. I actually don't know what it was like to live in the 1400s.
Under what?
a king who is going pretty gaga, let's be honest. But that's where research came in, and deciding how much of you know, what we understand as human experience would feed into their understanding of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balancing act, and it gets easier the more you write. But yes, a bold write what you know is not helpful to anyone, really.
No, not particularly.
let's move on to the next one, which is my absolute bugbear. Absolute, I hate this. I would write this piece of writing advice down thousands of times, and I would burn every single one of them, because I think it is the stupidest piece of writing advice I've ever encountered.
Yep.
So as long as you all get the scale of how much I hate this bit of writing advice, I'll go from there. I may not be the most unbiased source on this one. Basically, this is where you get people saying to you, you must only write in the perspective, the point of view of a character who shares your sex or gender. Therefore, but you mostly see this argument with men should not write women. Not only men should not write women in first person, men shouldn't write women in third person or at all. Women should never write men in first person or third person. And it's complete bollocks. It really, really makes no sense whatsoever. The idea that you cannot write in another perspective is just stupid. What you need to do is do your due diligence. You need to, I mean, assuming you're okay, let's say you're a woman and you're writing from the perspective of a man. Do you know men? Talk to them. Listen to how they talk. Ask them how they think and feel about things. It's not hard. It's not hard at all.
So yeah, I think this piece of writing advice came from basically men writing women incredibly badly, which is something that happened a lot in the past and still happens to this day. The amount of times I've seen those rather humorous extracts of just men writing women and talking about these women standing in front of the mirror naked, just thinking about their weighty breasts and all that and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's amazing how they're hyper aware of their breasts, written by men. There are men, obviously, who write women extremely well as well. You can look at literary writers like Colm Tóibín. You can look at Stephen King, mm-hmm. who always writes women very well as well. So it absolutely can be done. Oh, I was like, ah! It can be done. There are women who write men very well. It goes for not just two biological sexes, mm-hmm. but other genders as well. I think what you've got to do is make sure that you find people of that particular gender and talk to them about their experiences. Put yourself in someone else's shoes. That's kind of what being a writer is about, is putting yourself in someone else's shoes.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it all comes down to that research, you know, as we were saying at the end before. So the write what you know, that this is linked in very much with the write what you know. You talk to people, you actually just observe. I mean, there's also this fact that sometimes the differences aren't that big. And all I can think about is that how many men, when writing women, are like, oh, they must be so conscious of their breasts the whole time. And I'm like, I don't know, how conscious are you of your testicles constantly?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Maybe they really are. Maybe it's just like, sort of like they just assume that it's reflected. We obviously talked about this instance in an episode called The Horse's Point of View. And there is definitely some weight behind it, in the sense of, you know, men can tend towards writing female characters very, very badly. But to give prescriptive writing advice that says you must not, they must share your sex or your gender is utter bollocks.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's also very harmful, and I think it's worth mentioning that it's harmful because at the end of the day, still at the moment, the publishing industry in terms of who's being published, and in particular genres, is still very, very... Is secular the right word? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's very... well, it's 70% white for a start. And then of that... And then before you even slice it any further, it's probably about 70% male as well.
Which is weird, because actually I think most of the people who work in the editing side of the publishing industry are women. So... but yeah, so it's very dangerous if we then say to the writers, you can only write from one gender. Because ideally what we want in the future is to have a myriad of different people and different voices being represented in fiction, so the authors themselves. But actually a big part of getting to that next step and encouraging it is also to encourage this diversity of voice within literature. And one of the basic forms of diversity of voice that we're completely missing out now is female voices in stories, just female characters. And then just, I mean, diversity in general. I'm not even going to talk about how massively underrepresented, you know, people of colour are and people with disability and all of those things. So we need to actually encourage those kinds of characters to be appearing in fiction and to be appearing well represented, so that we can continue and further that movement of diversity, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the thing, isn't it? We want something that reflects reality. At the moment, if you just went by what we do see in publishing and in film, and that you would assume that reality is white and male and middle class, and the reality is that no, it's far more diverse than that.
Well, weirdly enough, I was talking about this very recently, in saying that actually, yeah, we do really need to be careful of how media, because media does have a massive influence on us. You know, there was that whole big shebang recently about, I don't even know what the TV series was, but there was a Sikh soldier being shown in a World War II.
Yeah.
And people went nuts about it. And they were like, well, they just wouldn't have been there, would they? And the fact is that these ideas of, okay, people wouldn't have been there, or that Victorian London was completely white, it comes from the media. It comes from the things that we see. No one here has actually visited Victorian London, unless you've got a cheeky time machine, okay? Which means that every image you have of Victorian London comes from through a very specific lens, you know? So media does have a massive influence on us, which means that actually, in order to make that change, we need to be willing to allow that change to actually happen on all levels. And I think that just allowing people to write different sexes is the least of it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so next, what about chasing trends or writing to the market? Don't chase trends.
Yeah, I love this as a piece of writing advice. On the surface, there is some sense in it, because by the time you have written a book, let's say it takes you a conservative year to 18 months to write an 80,000 word novel, and then you've got to edit it, and then you've got to find an agent, and then you've got to go through the process of the agent selling it. If you chase a trend, that trend is long gone. It's, you know, it is a speck in the distance by the time you've managed to jump on it. So from that perspective, that's wise advice, and you're better off writing something that you love. However, and there's a big however, if you indie publish books, you can get them out a lot quicker than that. And trend chasing is a viable way of actually making a living out of this. Now, I don't really mean trend chasing. What I mean is writing to market. And the thing you do there is you find a market in a subgenre that you write in already, that you love, that you're passionate about, so that when you write, everything comes out and the readers are really engaged mm-hmm. because they feel the writer loves what they're writing. And you find yourself a little niche in that hungry market and you write books set there.
Yeah.
And you will sell books. It is as simple as that. You will sell books. You will even sell them without much social media presence, without much marketing, without doing any advertising or the things that you should be doing in order to try and sell books. Because heads up here, guys, books don't sell themselves. You don't write a book, it yeah. lands, and then people just buy it. That doesn't work. You have to tell people about the books. So in terms of, you know, indie publishing, it's actually a really stupid thing to say don't write to market. It's not to say that you should write to market, it's just don't restrict yourself. If there's a market out there that you love, that you're interested in, if you want to write shapeshifter romances, then, you know, fill your boots, because people yeah. are buying that shit, loads of them. There is a hungry audience there who will buy the next one and the next one, and you can yes. sell your entire 12 book series. So it's just, it's a really, really restrictive piece of writing advice. And it kind of goes hand in hand with the idea that writing fast means that you write badly, that your writing is yeah. sloppy and that your books won't be any good. And that just isn't true. You can write very fast, but still write quality work. And to be honest, even if you weren't writing quality work and you were just writing pulp, there's a market for that too. So if your aim is to write books that you enjoy writing and make some money out of it, and it happens to be pulp and there's a hungry market for it, good on you. Ultimately, you fulfilled your two goals there.
Yeah,
there's too much snobbery around this, I think, is the issue.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think a lot of that snobbery is linked to this idea that these trends are all part of the lowest form of literature, which is basically these trends tend to be fantasy involved. It tends to be fantasy or speculative fiction, which are always really dismissed as a kind of the basest form of literature, as this commercial genre fiction. Yep. And so people get very snooty about, it's like, oh, well, you know, this latest trend, how annoying it is. And I can appreciate that on some level. It's just that there's one werewolf book and then there's another and then there's another and then there's another. But, you know, actually, the reason that is because people like it and people are buying it and people are going to read it. So there is a danger, I think, certainly of basically sitting down and going, oh, that's popular at the moment, so I'll write that kind of book. Because as Jules said right at the beginning, by the time you kind of get it out there, unless you've been very, very quick, it's likely that that's not going to be what's selling anymore. However, if you have a werewolf book on your computer and you go, now is my time, go for it.
Yeah. yeah, totally.
But I think ultimately it's about writing what you really love. Because even when a trend ends, as it were, there's going to be a publisher somewhere, if you want to go with traditional publishing, who's still going to be interested to kind of continue with that niche. And self-publishing as well always works. So trends are there because they up and go down with major popularity, but there will always then be someone who's a sucker for a group of readers who are still suckers for that particular thing and will keep reading that particular thing. So yeah, it's a mixed bag, really, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it definitely is. This does sort of tie into what we were just talking about, but it's... Basically, it's the idea that if you're making money from your writing, you're selling out. And the reverse of that is if you write for love alone and don't make money, then you're wasting your time and it's stupid.
Yeah.
Again, it's prescriptive writing advice. And I hate that, because that's suggesting that... Okay, let's say that Madeline was a brain surgeon and someone said to her, you shouldn't expect to be paid, you should be doing it for love alone.
Yeah.
Or let's say in reverse that, I don't know, Madeline was a banker and someone said to her, oh, but you shouldn't be making all that money, you're selling out. Can you think of any other career than writing where someone would tell you that one or other of those things was true? Because I genuinely can't. It only comes down to things where people are creating art.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Why shouldn't you want to be compensated for your time and creativity? There's nothing wrong with that. That doesn't make it any less art.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, again, there's this intellectual snobbery that comes from it. And it's born from this time where the people who were writing could afford to be writing for free because they were all incredibly rich.
Yeah.
Like, you would have these, you know, these dukes, these marquis, these, you know, all of these people who weren't writing because who were writing as part of a hobby, as form of this, you know, this pursuit of true art and literature, or because, yeah, I don't know, they were a bit weird. And it was the fact that, yes, we don't need to be compensated for this. So they weren't selling out. They were doing it because, you know, they were really pursuing the magic of literature and all of that jazz. Okay. It comes from that. And to be honest, that's not a healthy point of view. Because in the modern day, writing is an occupation. It's a job. Now, for some people, it's a hobby, and that's absolutely fine, and I encourage that, and great. But if you want to sit down and you want to make money from it, you're not a sellout if you do make money from it. And you shouldn't be discouraged, you know, or be told that you need to do it for free either. Your time is valuable and your skills are valuable. So it's this really, really horrifying kind of piece of advice, which weirdly enough seems to come from opposite ends. And I think in some ways that there's an element of jealousy from it, which is that on one level, it's people who don't understand art and just kind of think, I want that for free. They're not actually willing to pay up for something like that because they don't actually value it as much as they should. And on the other hand, I think there's a kind of this level of jealousy that comes into it, which is that, why are you earning money and I'm not? It must be because mine actually have a higher value, in a literary way. You're a sellout, you know, because you've just adhered to a trend, but no one's going to remember your name or anything like that. And again, it all comes down to this huge kind of emphasis which is put on literary fiction as being the pinnacle of writing. Whereas I'd like to point out that, first of all, literary fiction doesn't sell very well. That's not a criticism on anyone who does write literary fiction. It's very hard to do, but...
No, it's just got a much smaller audience. We're talking about audiences here. And when we were talking about sort of your shapeshifter romance earlier, that's got a huge hungry audience and they want the next book and the next and the next, and they're voracious and they just won't stop. And then you've got your literary fiction. It tends to take people longer to read, tends to take much longer to write. You can't just churn them out because the process tends to be a bit different, I find. Not true for everybody. And the audience is smaller and less hungry, and that's fine. There's no value more or less on either side there. It's just, you do tend to then say, oh, but all this genre fiction is choking the market and therefore people aren't buying literary fiction. And I'm like, to be honest, the people who are reading the genre fiction probably would never pick up the literary fiction because it's just not what they want to read. So nobody is no one's out competing anyone there.
Yeah, I'd also like to point out this idea that if you read genre fiction, you're less intelligent. No, you're just deciding what you want to do with your time. And also that all these things like, oh, you know, the classics, the true literary fiction, and they will list all these people off like Dickens and whatnot. And I'm like, that was genre fiction of the day. Really?
Oh God, yeah. That the way that people talked about the Bronte's novels, you know, a novel said in a very particular tone, as if to say, well, yes, that's rather like picking up heat would be today. And it's it's hilarious when you think about it, because apparently 200 years have made it great literature. So, you know, in 200 years, maybe this werewolf shapeshifter romance stuff will be great literature.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that certain things will survive, and it's not necessarily going to be the things that you expect to survive. So, yeah. Anyway, moving on, because we've got a list to get through.
We have, sorry.
Let's talk about marketing.
Yeah, that's... obviously it's a huge, huge topic, but the one I get a lot, and I see people saying it on Twitter and various other places, is book marketing is dead. Or rather, if you are not part of a big, traditionally published conglomeration, then you may as well forget selling your book. You can't sell your book by being on Twitter. You can't sell your book by doing various other things like blogging or doing blog tours or being on Instagram or, you know, taking pictures of your book and putting it up on your, on Facebook. Book marketing is dead. Yeah. And the people who say this, I think they're pretty much all male for some reason. And they all seem to think that what should have happened is that they put their book out there and then they said, buy my book 600 times on Twitter. And then nobody bought their book. Well, very few people did. Because people filter out things like that. People filter out actual adverts unless they are looking for a book at the time. So, of course, that didn't work. But to then say all book marketing is dead and you can't do anything as an indie is just utterly ridiculous, because people are proving all the time that that's not true.
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole, sorry, it really does make me laugh, because I think it's this real problem of people understanding what book marketing is or what marketing is. And I really do think the issue is that actually nowadays, people actually, you're not necessarily just advertising your book, you're kind of advertising yourself. And as an indie publisher, that's actually really, really super important, is to kind of create this following that comes with you as a person and you connecting with your readers and you building a community. Which means that if you're using Twitter and just constantly sort of pushing your book, without any kind of really showing of who you are as a person, people aren't going to pay attention. Whereas if you're using social media and things like that to connect with people, you know, if you're going out and meeting people, if you're doing talks and signings and you know, like being a human being, people are more likely to say, actually, yeah, I would like to try that. Because at the end of the day, it's an investment. It's an investment into something which is less guaranteed than if you go into a bookshop, which will have a very exclusive set of things, because of the shelf space. So you've kind of got to sell yourself.
Yeah, that is the big secret to marketing. And it took a while to really click, I think, for me. And I wouldn't say I was the best person at it now. Even now, because I'm still quite difficult, I still find it quite difficult to say, oh, by the way, I write books, you know. So that's quite a major hurdle. But, you know, the secret to marketing is, you're not selling your product, you're selling yourself, you're selling the story. That doesn't mean you're being deceitful. You're going out there and being the best version of yourself you can be, as Madeline has said. And I would also add the caveat, do the social media that you actually enjoy, do the social media marketing that you enjoy. Try lots of different things, and if you don't really like them, don't do that one. So for me, I prefer Twitter and Instagram and you know, my website and through my newsletter. And I can guarantee you won't get lots of book adverts from my newsletter either, because my newsletter is 90% me wittering on about folklore, interesting historical facts I've found out that month, and telling you what I've been doing writing wise. I've even got a little section called Tea of the Month where I tell you what my favourite tea flavour is that month. Do you know, the really funny thing is, that's all stuff that you think that people wouldn't be interested in, but I get way more sign-ups now that my newsletters are structured like that, because they're bizarrely interested in me as a person. I certainly get a lot more people writing back to me saying, oh yeah, I really enjoyed this segment, oh by the way, did you realise you got that fact wrong, than I ever got before, when I was just saying, oh by the way, I've got a special offer on the books. Obviously I do that as well, but the main thing is kind of like, I'm just going to witter about random stuff, and if you don't like it, you can always leave the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, you just, ultimately, that's what you want. You want people to invest in you as a person and as a writer, rather than just the book as a product. So book marketing isn't dead. It's just changed shape a little
bit. I mean, obviously, if you're traditionally published and they are willing to throw, I don't know, a £10,000 marketing budget behind you, then great. But you are still going to have to do a lot of this shit yourself, because that's not going to go very far if they throw that money in the wrong place. And publishers do sometimes.
Okay,
this is one that I kind of have, like, daymares about, you know?
Okay.
Where it's kind of like, quit your day job so that you can focus entirely on your writing. This is excellent advice if you've got to the point with your day job where it's actually getting in the way of your writing, and your writing is making you 5 times as much money as your day job is.
Yeah.
At that point, that's a case of, yeah, maybe you should think about quitting your day job, unless it's something you love so much that you just want to try and balance the two things.
Yeah.
If it's a case of you haven't got any books out, or you've got one book out and, I don't know, 12 people, including your grandparents and your parents, have read it, or not, as the case may be, and you're thinking, I'm ready for the big push, and you've got no savings, and you're just going to quit your job and magical things will happen. I know people who've done this and actually made it work. They made it work by working something like 15 hours a day, 7 days a week for an entire year to build up a huge back catalogue. Mm-hmm. And they say they were stupid to do it the way they did. The reason they did it was because they both got made redundant.
Yeah.
So it was a case of find something else, desperately scrabble around for a minimum wage job, or just write like hell and hope the savings held out until we got to that point.
Yeah.
It's not great advice. Yeah, okay, it's annoying that you have to do your day job, maybe. But you've got to eat. I guarantee that if you can't pay the bills and you can't eat, you're not going to be feeling super creative.
Yeah, I do think that that's actually quite important.
And, you know, Madeline has a day job. I have a day job. That's not to say we wouldn't one day like to just do writing, but
yeah, absolutely. It's about finding the balance between your job and your writing. Now, in my particular case, I like my job because it actually does give me time to write. It means that, you know, sometimes things are a little bit harder, things are a little bit tighter, but ultimately it's something that I've chosen. So there is something to be said about kind of not putting off writing, because I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people do. So they say, I'll wait till I'm retired to start my novel. Yeah. And I think it's also because people think that, right, when you start writing, you just then sit down and you bash it all out. And that's not actually a good idea at all, because you improve the more you write. Which means that even if only on the weekend you're sitting down and you only tap out 100 words at, you know, a week, you know, at the, you know, that will build up over time and you will get better. And I think you'd probably manage more than 100 words a week. You'd be surprised actually how much you tend to be able to get out. And even if you're not writing something for your actual novel, writing just a tiny bit, it's all going to make it better. So putting off writing isn't necessarily a great idea either. And if writing is something you are very serious about, then giving yourself time to write is a really good idea. But it's also actually about finding that balance, because I tend to find that unless you have, you know, actually a relative amount of experience when it comes to writing, in the experience of actually sitting down and writing itself, the act, if you say, right, I'm going to book a week off and I'm only going to write during that week, you will find very quickly that you don't. You do literally anything else other than write that week.
Yeah, absolutely. While we're on the subject of quitting your day job, let's say that you are one of those writers who managed to, through some extraordinary mixture of talent and luck, manage to score yourself a 3-book deal with a major publishing house and with an advance of £100,000 attached to it. That sounds really nice, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Let's look at how that works out. That is still not quit your day job money. So let's just say that, let's break that down. What happens is you'd sign that contract, hopefully it would be the beginning of a beautiful relationship, and you would write more books for them and you would still get the high advance. That's the absolute best case scenario. But what happens is that's 3 books. So you can take that $100,000, or £100,000, and you can cut it into 3. So you're looking at about £33,400, which is slightly less impressive, but still a nice wage. That gets divided as well. So generally, you get a third of that 33,400. Mm-hmm. So just divide that by three. So that's about £1,200. No, sorry, that's not £1,200. That's 12,000. No, 11,200 roughly.
Yeah.
Mental arithmetic, not my strong suit. Like to point that out. That's that's not really even a living wage, is it? And you get that first third of 11,000 pounds on signing. Then you would get 11,000 pounds on turning in the finished manuscript to their satisfaction, and then you would get that final instalment of 11,000 pounds on publication. Now, the entire publication process can take 2 years. From signing to actual publication of the book. So that's £33,400 that has to stretch across 2 years. I'm not sure what the average household income is, but that actually still falls below the average household income. And if you have got a family to support and pets and medical emergencies and various other things going on there, that's not going to keep you in stockings and fans, you know?
Stockings.
So it sounds like a really impressive amount. And you know what it is? It's great that some people get advances like that. But when you break it down, that's not, okay, I'm going to quit my day job and move to the bright lights of the big city type money, which is what I've seen some authors do. And it's terrible because this is the other thing people don't really want to look at. When somebody is bidding on you at a publishing house and they bid big like that, they think you're going to be a bright star. If you don't turn out to be a bright star with your books, and let's face it, most books don't ever earn out their advances. Ever. If you don't turn out to be one of those bright stars, your next advance is going to be possibly 1/5 of what the original one was. And then after that, you might just get offered a couple of thousand. So unless you turn out to be the investment that they're gambling you will be, you are not going to see that advance again.
Yeah.
So I realise that people don't like to hear this, but I think this is a really important thing to say. Don't go in thinking, oh, I'll write the next great British novel and that'll be it. I'll be made for life. There's a very slim possibility that'll happen, but you're more likely to not find that to be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Again, this isn't meant to be a discouraging thing. It is more than possible to live on your writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's not going to be, you're not going to be able to live on one book unless you have been insanely lucky.
No, I mean, maybe, but chances are you're going to be doing your day job as well. And to be honest, if you're writing the sort of literary fiction that tends to attract those advances at the start, then you're going to find that your royalties are probably never going to earn out for that book. And if your next book isn't as good, then your advance is going to go down, not up. So don't think that 100,000 for a 3-book deal is your starter. It's not necessarily your starter. That might be it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, not trying to be discouraging. It's just go in with some realistic expectations. That doesn't mean you can't write loads more stuff in various different genres if you want to. Don't assume that you've made it, I think, is what I'm getting at here.
This does sound like we're being really discouraging. I'd like to point out we're not.
I think the problem is that, you know, I wouldn't say I went in with unrealistic expectations, but they were more unrealistic than they should have been, and that's because nobody wants to talk about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah. And again, this is the other problem for these particular authors who get these big advances, is that nobody gives them any pointers when it comes to marketing, or people say your publishing house takes care of that, and they don't realise that actually they kind of need to get out there and sell themselves a little bit.
Yeah.
And it compounds it. And if your publisher thinks you're losing the money, they will cut you. You'll still get the entirety of the advance.
Sorry, when Jill says they'll cut you, she doesn't mean they'll break into your house with a knife. I'm just going to point that out there, because that's kind of what it sounded like.
Sorry, no, they will cut you from their list. But bear in mind that they might be lovely, wonderful, warm, welcoming people, and they might genuinely be that. but they're also a business first and foremost. So hopefully it'll be a lovely partnership where you're friendly and it's lucrative and you spend many, many years together. Be prepared for the fact it might not be.
Yes.
So
this feels really harrowing somehow.
It does. While we're on the subject of publishing houses, another personal bugbear. I can't believe we're still having this conversation in 2020, but only traditional publishing is valid.
Yeah.
Self-publishing is an act of desperation rather than a viable business model.
Or an act of vanity or something like that as well.
Yeah. Where to start with this one? Okay, again, this is one of those this is complete bollocks statements. Obviously, we've just talked about how it can pan out money-wise if you want to write professionally for money with a traditional publisher.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work out that way, and those huge advances are quite unusual. You're more likely to get something in the sort of 5,000 range, probably, particularly if you write genre fiction and you're going with a big publishing house. But that's not the only thing that's valid. There is so much indie published stuff now that is professionally edited. It's well structured. It's written to market, so it's being written into a market that's hungry for it already. It's being carefully reviewed and cover designed and packaged, and the authors know what they're doing, and they are building mailing lists, and they are building followings on social media. They are engaging in the way that they find it enjoyable and genuine. And it is absolutely a viable business model. And it's viable in a way that, unfortunately, traditional publishing can't quite match because of the way that they are set up at the moment.
Yeah.
If we're talking about writing for money, you have got better chance of making a living wage much, much sooner in your career via indie publishing, as long as you've done your research, than you have through traditional publishing. Or through a combination of the two, in fairness. A combination of the two also works.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that with the problem comes from the fact that publishing on both sides will have its extremes. So there will be some traditionally published novels which are excellent and some traditionally published novels which are really terrible. Really terrible. And there will be some indie published books which are fantastic and some indie published books which you would really rather never see again. The fact of the matter is that really realistically, just because there is a larger quantity of stuff available doesn't mean that it's not worth something. And just because someone has decided to kind of take the plunge and do it themselves, again, doesn't mean that their story isn't worth telling or that their story isn't any good. And it's particularly important because, as we mentioned right at the beginning of the episode, there is this discrimination that continues to exist in the publishing world. And publishers, it's a business. They've got to make a lot of money if they're going to kind of, you know, actually earn anything from investing in you and your book, which means they've got to be 100% sure, which means they've got to kind of really sort of be sure they're going to meet these certain statistics and figures. And if they're not feeling like it will work 100%, they're not going to invest in you. That doesn't mean that that book isn't spectacular or that it's not actually going to sell incredibly well. And we are seeing more examples of some very, very, you know, like some indie books which have done incredibly well. Yeah. So this idea that they're this kind of this small vein and kind of less well-written or less well-produced product is incorrect. And you can't judge on the fact that there are some badly produced self-published books out there. There are, of course there are. There are some badly produced traditionally published books as well. And in terms of diversity and in terms of actually getting more voices out there and more opinions and saturating the market with much more colour of you know and just making it so much bigger with all these voices, you know, that trumps it for me as far as I'm concerned. I know it's everybody's dream to get that big traditional publishing thing, but I think that you should also hold value if you have self-published as well, because it's an incredibly difficult process too.
Yeah, it's as much work, if not more, because you have to be able to wear lots of different hats. So it's absolutely valid, particularly if you're trying to actually produce a decent book. And
yeah.
I think the thing is, when a traditional publisher signs up someone, they're still gambling. They're gambling on that book selling. They don't know. And how much marketing money they devote to it is sort of a bit of an indication of how much, you know, if they've given you a big advance, they'll probably put more marketing behind it.
Yeah.
If you get a large advance from a big publisher, that's kind of more of a guarantee that they'll put some marketing funds behind it. A lot of people sign with big publishers and ask what marketing budget they're getting and generally get laughed at.
Yeah.
Whereas if you are doing it by yourself, yes, it's a lot of work. You have to put the money in, you have to pay for the cover designer, you have to pay for the editing, etc., etc. You are being asked to invest in your own product. And I can understand why some people, particularly new authors, feel a bit nervous about doing that, because that's like that's nailing your colours to a mast and saying, I believe 100% in what I'm doing with this, without having a big publishing house to back you up and say, yeah, we think this is a valid book. But that's kind of what you have to do. You have to believe in your book enough to invest in it. And, you know, it doesn't have to be mega bucks necessarily. You can, if you're willing to learn various different talents and skills by yourself, which can take a long time, you can do a lot of it by yourself in theory, depending on where your skill set lies, and you can trade skills with somebody else as well. Ultimately, at least you are in charge of your own marketing and how much effort is being put behind it. You're not left playing the waiting game wondering whether your book is selling or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, you know, it goes to show that a lot of people who don't really appreciate the difficulties of self-publishing need to understand that for the people who are going to put forward that amount of money, you know, that's an investment that they've made, which means that they're probably really, really going to make sure, going to make that effort to make sure that it works. Now, a few people are going to do that badly, true. But if you're willing to put in that time and that effort, it's usually because you know that you have something good. And for the most cases, while you do have the occasional delusional person, most writers I meet are like, well, I'm not quite sure that it's ready yet.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I tend to find that actually a lot of self-published stuff that is sort of making it is good. It's good stuff.
Yeah, generally.
Okay. All right, so the next one, this is one that really annoys me a little bit, and it's the kill all adverbs or adjectives, just get rid of them.
Yeah, okay, I get from the perspective of new writers learning to write and put sentences together in interesting ways that vary, can fall prey to the not using active verbs but using qualifying verbs or basically adverbs in order to make an action more exciting.
Yeah.
And that's something you will learn to stop doing gradually. But to kill all adverbs, there are times when a well-placed adverb or adjective is actually a better choice than to use a more active verb.
Mm-hmm.
Or it conveys the meaning of what you're trying to impart better than a verb. Maybe you want someone to say something softly rather than whisper, you know?
Yeah.
That's just a very off-the-cuff type example, but there's a place for them. So saying you must remove an entire subset of words is ridiculous.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that it all comes down actually to understanding the power of individual words.
Yeah.
Which is that it's a little bit like flavour in a meal, you know. If you add lots and lots and lots and lots of different flavours into a single meal, it's going to be overpowering. But if you use one particular flavour and you use a nice blend, then it's going to be, you know, interesting, enjoyable. And it's the same when you use adverbs and basically other words like that.
Yeah.
It's the same. If you use them, and I'm not going to say sparingly, but if you use them potently, if you use them with purpose, they can really add something amazing to the writing. But if you overuse them, isn't the same as if you overuse anything. Even the best writing then can just be dragged down by just being overstuffed. It's too much of a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And it, I guess it's also the flavours on one plate, isn't it? Type thing.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You might like curry and you might like ice cream, but you wouldn't necessarily want to eat them out of the same dish at the same time.
There is someone listening right now who's going to be like, ooh, hoo, hoo.
Challenge accepted.
Rubs their hands together.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same with various other things, like never use passive voice. There is a time and place for passive voice. Yes, if you want your writing to be engaging and pull your reader in, you should be trying to use active voice most of the time. So, for example, I'm just trying to think examples of active and passive voice. All I'm coming up with, okay, active voice, the cat was sat on the mat. So the cat, you start with the cat. The cat is the person doing something. Passive voice would be the mat was sat on by the cat. It's where you make the passive noun the subject of the sentence. What was the mat sat on? It was sat on by the cat. Now, unless you're telling a very weird story from the mat's perspective, that is passive voice. You could say the cat shat on the mat. The mat was shat on by the cat. You know, the mat was having a really bad day, so it was the mat's perspective. Anyway, sorry, my brain has started pre-associating. And those are really, really...
This feels like a Dr. Seuss. It feels like that's what we're going on.
But there is a place for passive voice. Maybe a character feels uncertain in a situation and they are withdrawing into themselves. And you don't want to say that she felt uncertain and therefore she withdrew into herself. So what you do is you use passive voice. You describe the things around the character. You have her step back a little bit from the action. That's perfectly valid usage of passive voice. Or maybe you've just had a massive action scene and the person is in shock and therefore they're not necessarily focusing or being analytical in the way they're thinking about things. Therefore, again, passive voice is a good thing for varying. Yes, use it sparingly, but it's definitely a place for it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. As we've said, it's just about not using the same paintbrush constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll sort of put these two together because they're kind of my minor bugbears. And it's prescriptive writing advice. There's a definite trend here with writing advice for me. It's a case of people saying you mustn't plan, you must just be creative. If you plan, then you're not creating art. The reverse being, if you pants, as in if you fly by the seat of your pants and just write with no clear direction, then you're being sloppy and undisciplined and you probably won't ever finish a book.
Yeah.
So that's part one of this. I would say bollocks to both of those, because everybody writes slightly differently. Stephen King is a notorious pantser. He starts and he just finishes wherever. He just follows the characters to see what happens. He's one of those rare people who can completely pants from the beginning to the end. And he has tried plotting and planning, but he's found it doesn't work for him. And you know what? That's fine. J.K. Rowling, on the other hand, plans. She thinks she plans loosely, but having seen her plans, I'm kind of like, okay, that's way more intricate than any of my plans. And again, she ends up exactly where she wants to be too. So you can be either, and you can be anything in between, and it's whatever gets you to the end of a book or whatever keeps you engaged in writing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, again, it's just this idea that there's not one way of doing things, guys.
Yeah.
we really can, you know, come at things from multiple different angles, and that's okay, and everybody kind of has their own way of doing things. But yeah, it does always make me laugh a tiny bit, the whole sort of, this is the one way, and I'm like, really? the one and only way for every single writer in the entire world.
You must all do it. Yeah, it's not maths, is it? It's not a case of this equation will always yield this result, or it should do. This is a case of, no, everyone approaches this slightly differently, and that's okay. It doesn't matter how you run the race, it's how you get to the end.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I pantsed my way through I Belong to the Earth. If you saw my sheet of notes for that, you would laugh and scratch your head and then wonder if I was writing in hieroglyphics. It's literally one page with three circles on it. It's kind of a Venn diagram. That was my notes for I Belong to the Earth. It was a Venn diagram. And then I got really, really stuck with book two. Really stuck for such a long time. And I found that creating a plan helped me get unstuck. And I've created a plan for every book since then. I don't create massively detailed plans. I have a rough idea outline and I roughly break it down into chapters. They invariably move. I invariably go off piste, but having a plan, a map, means that I know which direction I'm going in, and it doesn't matter if I then decide to take a shortcut through the woods.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But not everybody has to work that way. I just find that works for me, particularly since I write fast and I get very frustrated if I get myself stuck.
Oh, I hadn't noticed.
You've noticed more than anyone else. Madeline's kind of like the long-suffering spouse in this writing relationship. Did you have a bad day at work today, dear? Yes, I just can't get past this scene.
The most annoying thing is that Jules would be like, oh, I'm really struggling with writing today. Like, I've only written like 3,000 words today. And I'm like, you mother... I only managed to write like two novellas in the last couple of weeks, and you just hear me storming out of the room.
I'm slacking. The divorce is coming any day now, you can tell.
Jules is one of these people who needs to be reminded that she's doing just fine.
Yeah, and that's fair. That I think everybody needs a little bit of that sometimes, but I do put very high expectations on myself. So every so often someone's saying, yes, but you have done all this. Can we just look at Exhibit A and Exhibit B? And if you still don't believe me, Exhibit C is right here. And usually I'll go, oh yeah, you're right. And that very act of de-escalating my frustration tends to unstick me, and then I'm good to go. So, you know, you should all have writing buddies if you possibly can.
Yes, they're lifesavers.
On the subject of word count, yes, I do set myself a daily word count. That doesn't mean you have to. Neither do you have to write every day. The process of writing is sometimes the process of writing is watching lots and lots of TV series. Sometimes it's reading lots of other books. Sometimes it's going for long walks or listening to music, or, you know, dancing around the house, singing folk songs. All of these things, anything that stimulates the whole creative process for you, that's all part of writing. Sometimes writing is sitting and staring into space.
Yeah, it really is. And I think people forget that, in that writing, there's so much more to the process of writing than actually tapping the keys or moving the pen.
Yeah.
So don't feel like you've conked out if you said, this is my writing hour and all I did was sit and think. Like, actually, your brain is problem solving, even if you're not necessarily always conscious of it, let it happen, okay? Yeah. Every now and again, give yourself a push, but don't, you know, throw yourself off the cliff.
I mean, honestly, if you set yourself, maybe you're someone who it works with writing goals, you will know the difference between you working through something on the back burner and you actively slacking. Because if you are actively slacking, you will know that you're doing it. I like to have writing goals. I don't always hit them. I set myself sort of 5,000 words a day. I don't hit that more than 3 or 4 times a week. And some weeks...
I hate you sometimes. I hate you so much sometimes.
Some weeks I don't hit that at all. And some weeks I'll hit 10,000 in a day. The important thing is not to beat yourself up over it. The goal is there just as a guideline for me. And I know it's an achievable goal. So, I mean, your goals should be... You've heard of SMART goals, right? Mm-hmm. So they should be achievable. They should be low enough to hit, but high enough to strive for. They should be measurable. They should be, you know, attainable. They should be timely, etc., etc. And I find that really works for me, but that might not work for everybody. So it's a case of find what works for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually think that we've run out of time.
I think we've bombarded them with enough writing advice for one day.
Yeah.
Or lack of writing advice in some areas.
Basically, guys, just do you. Find the thing that works for you. And don't judge how fast you're going by how fast anybody else is going. I think the last bit of writing advice that I'd like to give, and this is good writing advice, is that there is never a right time to start writing.
Yeah.
So just do it. Whether it's just a few words scribbled down in a notebook, whether it's an idea that you're planning in your head, whether it's, you know, a whole day that you dedicate towards achieving that end novel, just do it. And don't worry about the rest of it just yet, okay?
Definitely.
Right. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I actually have a very topical one for you, which Jules and I have both read and both really enjoyed. And it's... And I've just forgotten the name. What's his first name?
John York.
Yeah, that's it. John York. I was going to say Tom York for some reason. Then I went, that's not right. So it's John York's Into the Woods, which is an excellent book, which it was actually written for writing for the screen and writing scripts. But it's completely useful no matter what kind of, whether you're writing for script or writing novels and things like that. It's a brilliant, very comprehensive writing guide. I just found it really, really useful. Even information that you know, having it reiterated to you in such an easy and kind of chewable way was fantastic.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So definitely worth exploring Into the Woods. It's a nice short little book as well. So very, very easy and very handy. If you just kind of want to lean over and read a page a day, it won't take you years. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week. Yeah,
thanks, goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.